Good evening. My name is John Hillegas, and I'm an alcoholic. And for identification purposes, I'm a redneck alcoholic. I got sober in South Carolina. And right now, the first part of my job is to get you people comfortable with me being up here. And I remember an old story that a speaker told me that I used to love to listen to. His name was Charles L. His nickname was the Arkansas Traveler. And he was talking about the time that he was sitting up here trying to get you people comfortable. And there's an old boy down in the front row with a .44 just rolling that chamber back and forth, you know. And the more he'd roll that chamber, the more Charles would get nervous. And finally, he looked down at him, and the guy looked up at him and said, "Don't worry, son." He said, "I ain't here to shoot you. I'm here to shoot that guy that put you up here." Now, for purposes of tonight, Marcy's the one that got me up here, all right? And I understand the other guy's in Denver. Okay. All right. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, the best description of my type of alcoholism, I was a depressive drunk. And it says in there you can write volumes about people like me. And I didn't wake up one morning deciding I was a depressive drunk and I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking career started out, I don't know when. I do know by the time I was 16, I was having blackouts. I was wrecking vehicles. By the time I was 17, I was married and in the Navy. And by the time I turned 18, I had my first daughter. I never could understand until the inventory process what kind of what was really going on in my life. I started out life in Nebraska. My parents lived there. My grandparents lived in Iowa. And my grandfather owned a tavern over in Chelsea, Iowa. And I can remember going to Grandma's house and for Christmas and Thanksgiving and sleeping on the living room floor. And the nightlight was a Ham's beer sign or the Schlitz beer sign or the Budweiser sign. So I never learned anything about social drinking. It wasn't taught in my house. People got drunk. People got hurt. There was car wrecks. There was women hurt. There was children hurt. There was a whole different world from what I lived in, from what I've seen on the outside. I did go to church when I was young. I was put on a Sunday school bus and I was sent over to this church. And from about the age of 6 until the time I got 13, about 13 was when my dad said I didn't have to go anymore. And my concept of God was I knew I was going to go to hell because I didn't eat my peas, you know. And it was a fact. I just scared to death of this concept of God or Jesus or anything like that. Well, I didn't wake up, like I said, and decide I was going to get sober. I'd been in trouble before. I'd had DUIs. I'd been in trouble in other foreign ports with my drinking. The last time I drank was on August the 15th. It was a military payday. My wife was pregnant with our fourth child. And I was arrested that night again for DUI, resisting arrest, and attempted jailbreak. And as being in uniform at the time, the judge told the shore patrol, he said, "You need to take this thing, this sailor, whatever you want to call him, and do something with him, you know." And the process was, at that time, is that there wasn't no drug court or anything like that. They were recommending that I would see a psychiatrist. Well, there was an alcohol rehab program in the Navy. It was not very well known in 1973. And being on a small destroyer like I was, there was no medical officer there. I had to go over to a tender repair ship, which had a medical officer, which could write a referral for me to see a psychiatrist. And a little chief intervened at the time. I don't know the gentleman's name. He said, "Sailor, I don't think you're crazy." He said, "But I think you might want to talk to the people on the fifth floor at the Naval Hospital. They deal with alcohol." And I went in there, and 20 minutes later, I had a bed, you know. And I didn't know if I really wanted one. up to this point that my whole life was in chaos. My marriage was best described by the statement my wife made to me probably about 6 months before I quit drinking, was that there would be no way I'd ever get a divorce. She said her whole goal in life was to make me as miserable as I've made her. And she was serious. She was flat serious. I wound up in that hospital, and the first honest thing that came out of my mouth was 16 days later when I came out of detox, and I was laying in bed beside her, and she was pregnant. She was about 8.5 months pregnant at the time, and I said, you know what? We've been reading in the book. She'd been coming up there, Wednesday's wife group, and we've been reading in the book there, and I said, I'm not supposed to make any major decisions for the first year. I really don't know if I love you or not here, but I'll stick around and we'll see what'll happen. And she says, I agree with you and we'll try it for 1 year. That's been 37 years ago. Okay, she's still there. The thing of it is that when asked by a minister, my wife, how she'd stayed married so long, she told her, says, the secret was we never fell out of love with each other at the same time, you know. And the other thing was that what she really wanted to say is that with our programs, we have ups and downs in our lives and our marriages, but luckily they haven't come crashing down together at the same time. One of us has always been sane while the other one's been a little bit screwy, you know. And that was the beauty of this program. Now, how you get there is described in the back of the book in A Vision for You, and it's very simple. It says, you've got to abandon yourself to God, clear away the wreckage of your past, and join us in the fellowship. Well, I didn't really get into this God concept when I first came into that program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked looking out there, and there was nice people out there, and I didn't think they would have anything to do with me. And they'd say, well, I'm sober today because of God. And I didn't realize that God was actually working in my life, but he was. I think you're losing my... You going to lose me? No, okay. I come to find out, you know, that this God spiritual experience is a time process. It was for me. I didn't wake up that first day in the hospital, or even after I was released from the hospital, with an honest desire not to drink. I was given a drug called Anabuse, and I was told I had to stay on the Anabuse for 1 year as part of the agreement with the Navy. And at that point there, they took away my choice to drink or not to drink, you know. But it was about 6 months of going to meetings. I had a sponsor, and he kept pressing me to do the fourth step, but I hadn't got that far. We had talked about the third step, and we hadn't got that far. And he gave me a prayer to say. He said, Don, when you get up in the morning, he says, when you reach down to get underneath the bed to get your shoes, I want you to say, God, don't let me get in any trouble you can't get me out of. And if I make it through that day, I'm supposed to put my shoes back down there that night and say, God, thank you. That's all I had to say. In about 6 months, I was driving out the gate. I was going to on my way home, and my old 66 Rambler that had three round wheels and one square wheel, you know. And you knew it had oil in it because it leaked everywhere. You know? But the thing of it was is that one moment of peace and serenity came out. And I found out that at that point there, it was about 6 months of this program, it was going to be all right not to drink. It didn't come overnight for me, you know. It's just a spiritual experience, as I said, it's a time process with me. I talked to my sponsor about that third step. And we come to some basic concepts. And the first concept was that we didn't know God was going to open the gates of heaven and let me in, but he was pretty sure that this God in Alcoholics Anonymous would open the gates of hell and let me out. And he did. And as I said in the beginning here, it's the first three steps. You know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, you know, and to turn my life well over care of God. The three pertinent ideas as I read in the book and how it works. You got to excuse me, I'm a little bit nervous. I haven't done this in a while. But the process came to that when I got my first year, I knew I was crazy as hell, but I'll be better next year, you know. And the second year, I was crazy as hell, but I know I'll be better next year, you know. I kept coming back, and I was getting better. And I didn't know I was getting better, you know. And it tells you right there in the family afterwards, you know. I was getting better and I didn't even know it. My wife, one night I was sitting there watching TV. Wednesday night was her Al-Anon night. I was watching TV and I started laughing. Some stupid TV program. I don't even remember what it was. And she looked through the kitchen and says, and I looked at her, she's like, "What's wrong with you, woman?" You know, and she says, "Nothing." She says, "I just haven't heard you laugh like that in years." You know? And that was a program of God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But that turning it over to God wasn't really enough. And I didn't get involved with the real meat of the program for me was getting into the inventories to find out, you know, what my part of this thing is. And when I got into the inventories, two things came apparent. I wasn't that good at being that bad. And the other thing was that alcohol was only a symptom of the disease. It wasn't my problem. I've worked, if you want to call it that, I've worked about four or five, maybe more four steps in my life. But even today, when I get into situations, I have to go share my problems, or if you want to say that, or I have to go run this process through my friends. Right. The recovery phase, or recovery phase, is steps four, where we made his fearless inventory, five, and which is very important. I can make an inventory. I can tell you what's wrong with me in my mind, but I will not be honest enough to tell you to your face what's wrong with me. You know. So I have to have that fifth step. I have to admit to God and to myself and know Him, the exact nature of my wrongs. And then six and seven become very easy for me after I've admitted to you, because you know what's wrong with me. Now I have to do something about it. The eighth step gets a little tough again. And that's one of the mistakes I made from my first inventories. I didn't write down these people that I'd harmed in my eighth step. And being geographic like I was in the United States Navy for several years, I would get transferred and I've lost contact, you know. And one of the things that I regretted is I don't know if I've made all of them. I've made a lot of amends, but I don't know if I've made all of the amends that I should have made or needed to make. I've done all of them that I could do. I know that. All right. Inventories are funny. You know, we really don't like looking at ourselves. We don't like bringing down this ego thing, you know. And I had a hell of a problem with my ego, you know. I always had to hate somebody. There had to be a son of a bitch in my life. Even in sobriety, I had to have one. Somebody to take all the blame for what's going wrong with God. You know, and it was quite a while before I could figure out it's all right to have nothing going on in your life. You know, it's okay. You know, my wife even found out. I even found out she was okay. You know, she used to be my SOB for quite a while. I still am hers once in a while. But you know, it's all right to laugh. You know, okay. But this is. I'm serious. It's just one of them things that I always had to have turmoil, you know. And when I finally was able to get to the point where I could let go and let God, And amazing things started to happen, you know. Somebody would come up and say, you know, I have this problem, and I could identify with him. I could give him advice. Didn't have to tell him how to do it. I just gave him my experience, you know. And after a while, I got thrown out of high school. I was sponsoring a doctor and a clergyman, an accountant. And the doctor was a urologist, and you guys are several years my senior as far as an age goes, but I found out that this program was about people. It wasn't their pedigree, you know. I used to categorize, that guy must be a low bottom brook. That gal, she must have got here by spilling wine on her silk blouse or something. You know, always categorizing people, you know. And I got down to the point in my life that it wasn't necessary, you know. Me and Dr. Roche would talk several hours, you know, what's going on, you know. One of the greatest experiences I had was happened to me about 5 years ago, and the guy was a lawyer. He was a good friend of mine. And he asked me to be a sponsor, and this guy intellectually was way more my superior, but he just needed somebody to talk to, you know. And the day he came up to me, he said, Don, he says, I've got 2 years to live. And we said, what are we going to do about this? Well, there's nothing we can do about that. But the one thing that we agreed upon, we were going to make every day count. We may not have quantity, but we're going to have quality of life. And we'd get up. I got up in the morning at 5 o'clock in the morning because he needed to go walking to keep his strength up to get through that day. You know, and I'd get up and we'd go walking. He'd tell me corny jokes like, well, there's the Southern Star, and I'm a sailor, you know, and I know the Southern Star ain't in this hemisphere. You gotta go down, you gotta get across the equator, you know. And the guy was a pilot. I knew all, and the guy was a DJ at a radio station. You know, I knew all about his life. I knew the good, I knew the bad, and I knew the ugly. And he knew it all about me, and he loved me. It's just the same, you know. And when he passed away, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. You'll have to excuse me a minute, but I was in his room with his daughter when he took his last breath. And from that point on, I learned that there's got to be quality, not quantity. I recall stories, and I used to be that. I used to act like that. You know, I'm. I heard it from Father Martin. I don't know if any remember him, but he did a movie called Chalk Talk, and they made a tape for me when I was at sea one time in the Mediterranean. He was out to Charleston Air Force Base, and he came up, and the guy he says he talked about the guy that says, I was a drunken SOB for 25 years, and I've been Alcoholics Anonymous for 20 years, and I'm just a sober SOB. And somebody said, oh, ain't that a shame about his lack of progress? And that touched my heart. Because I didn't want to be that way. I didn't want to go out of here as a grouch, you know. I didn't want to leave the mark that I've seen a lot of men in my life leave, that God, I'm glad when he's dead, you know. So at that point on, I recognized that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of quality, you know. It doesn't say that you're going to have good days every day. I can't tell you that's going to happen. I have bad days, but I know how to deal with them today. I have people that I can call. I've been kind of stagnant in the sponsorship area for a few years, and then this guy comes up and he says, you know, I'd like you to talk to me, to be a sponsor. My take on sponsorship is being a friend. But I can't be a sponsor unless I have a sponsor. So the guy, you know, kind of forced me off center, and I'm talking and thinking about asking this one gentleman to become my sponsor, you know. Because I can't sell what I don't have myself, you know. If you're new in this program, that's 24 hours a day at a time, and it's even for us old timers, it's the same way. You know, I believe that the spiritual experience that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous is ongoing. It changes from day to day. The third phase of this program is I'm joining the fellowship. I cook breakfast now. I cook pancakes. I ain't quite got it down yet, but I'm doing pancakes with the sprinkles, right? You know? And I don't mind going over to a little place called Wood Lake to listen to a meeting, you know. I like the idea of getting in a car, driving down the road to somebody else in the program. That way I have a meeting before the meeting and a meeting after the meeting. One of the craziest things that happened when we were so broke when I first got sober. The only time I could take my wife out was when we left the Friday night meeting, and she was in Al-Anon, I was going to the A meeting. And the Bob's Big Boy in Charleston, we used to go there and get a strawberry pie and a cup of coffee, you know. And then were the real special times in our lives today, you know. It took me almost 5-6 years to square away my finances because of my drinking, you know. And I cannot even estimate how much money I lost through my alcoholism. Through the wrecked cars, the drinking, and the fines. But, you know, it all came back. And even today, it's just, you know, we developed rules that worked with us. You know, there's just the simple things in life. We have a rule, we don't fight in our house. If it's going to get verbal, we go out to a restaurant. And then... No, it keeps it down and it keeps it real. And that was taught to her by her first sponsor. You know? It keeps one of us from taking control. And I have a control problem. Used to. Still do. I'm honest, you know? But of all the healing that goes on, has gone on in my life, I'd like to stand up here tonight and tell you it's not... It's all done, but it's not true. See, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 26 years old. Basically, when they first got me, I went from adolescence to alcoholism. I woke up one day and found out I had a wife and 4 kids. And then I had to learn how to be a dad, a husband. I had my second sponsor. That was his job, to teach me how to live with my family. Because they were driving me nuts, I thought. And in reality, I was driving them nuts, you know, because I didn't know how to deal with it. And Dick and I worked together for about 2.5 years, putting this thing back on track for me. And I'll stop here. I'll tell you 2 things about sponsors. They're kind-hearted people, and they give out good advice. Sometimes they don't follow their advice, you know. My first sponsor, the guy that taught me how to get sober, got drunk in 6 years. And he's back in the program now, and I believe he lives in London, England. My second sponsor, Dick, the one who helped me put my family together, I was walked into his house and helped move the furniture out from when his wife and him decided to get a divorce. So I believe in the concept that, you know, you need to look in the book and do what the book says, you know. Sometimes you don't want to read somebody as your big book. You know, the first 103 pages of this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is dedicated to getting sober. Including myself, some of us don't follow it exactly as it is written. But we always have the option to go back and do it over again. You know, and I have had to do that in some cases. And that's the same way when I'm dealing with other people. I have a choice today. You know, I can't say, oh, crap, I screwed it all up and let it die. I have the choice to say, I did this wrong and I want to start over, you know. The thing about the book, the family, was that we've been going along doing real well, you know. Then about 25 years, I thought I was doing it just great. And this woman says, I was doing something wrong, probably everything, but I was doing something wrong. And she goes, you know, Don, she says, are you my best friend? And I stopped to think about this for a little bit. And I says, yeah, I love you. She says, no, are you my best friend? And I said, no, I love you. She says, no, you wouldn't say things to me, to your AA friends, like you say to me, you know. So she taught me another lesson in life, you know. I try to treat all you people the same. My family, I treat my AA friends like my family, and my friends, my family like I do my AA friends. You know? There's no two standards. So we went on a little further, and the next thing you know, I'm a grandpa. Yeah, that's what I said, huh? I was 40 years old when my first grandchild was born, you know. And a bouncing little girl, and for a long time, that's all they seemed to know how to do in my family, is have little girls. And I had a license plate that said, 5 girls and 2 boys, grandpa's girls rule. That was my license plate frame. But we got involved in their lives, you know, and this was due to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to get involved and knew where the boundaries were. You know, not so much, they didn't do everything perfect, even to grandma's standard, but I knew where the boundaries were. Well, yeah, I let them grow up and I let them learn how to live, you know. And about 6 years ago, I became a great-grandfather. And that's brought on changes. My life has been in constant change, and that's why I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. I need to review my life where I'm at. The one thing that I've discovered here is that, you know, if you have people that you can trust and you can talk to, and you go to meetings on a regular basis, you're usually pretty happy, pretty well contented. My life is owed in so many parts of the world that it'd be beyond description. I know my first overseas meeting was in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I sailed after the Navy sobered me up. I sailed for 16 years with them, you know, sober. And I've been to meetings, and I went to a meeting in Rota, Spain, and there was a little girl there that said, would you come back and let's do a meeting at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? I said, what? She said, I want to practice telling my story so when I go to New York that I'll know if it's coming out right. You know, that's what this program was about, you know. You know, and she wanted to share her life. And everybody here has shared my life. I was in Japan, and I walked into Shore Patrol headquarters voluntarily, not drunk. And the fellow was sitting at the table with a big book in his hand. I says, is this a meeting? And he says, yeah. He says, well, what time does this start? And he says, as soon as you sit down. And I come to find out that Jack had been open that meeting for several months, and once in a while, somebody would come in. But it was announced that there was an AA meeting, and he was going to make sure that there was somebody there. I guess I'm kind of shotgunning at this point here. I guess I never got over the fact of being nervous because Marcy was here. But, you know, at this point, I'm gonna let you ask any questions you want. Right. Thank you for being here, because if you wasn't here, I wouldn't be here.
How about maybe go over how you picked your sponsor? How you went through that each time, and maybe how you went through some of the steps with them. And
sponsorship is very important, and one of the things you need to look at is that is trust. All right, and the people that I picked, the first sponsor I picked was a guy that took the intake interview in Charleston Naval Hospital with me. He wasn't a consular at the time, but he later become one. And DT was a chief torpedoman. He was a big guy. He was kind of like me. He was kind of simple and quiet and reserved. And he was new to the program himself. I think he'd been sober about a year and a half when I first came in here. And he was one of the reasons that that I stayed sober was the fact that he was very disciplined about going to meetings, and I hated going to meetings in the beginning. You need to go to meetings every night of the week, quote unquote. And I had some philosophical differences to that. The second sponsor was a guy by the name of Dick D, and he had a terrific wife. And say how messed up it was is the fact that I was at that time I was so sick, and he was in the program at the same time with me. His wife and my wife were pregnant with their third and my fourth one. And they were actually wound up having the two girls together at the Naval Hospital. And then I run across Dick, and his girls are happy. And I couldn't stand my kids. Couldn't stand my kids being around me, you know. And they were young, and they were at that age where they needed a father. They were at that age where they needed a playmate, you know. Other sponsors I picked on is I looked for their program and spirituality. The third guy was up in Newport, Rhode Island when I got stationed up. His name was Dick, and he had the spiritual concept going down pretty well. I wanted to make some mention of the fact that, you know, all the prayers that you're going to need in Alcoholics Anonymous are written in the big book. The 11-step prayer, the 3rd-step prayer, the 7-step prayer. However, it's been my experience, I've seen people go to outside groups and work a spiritual program, you know, and discussing these things about how to get along in life without, destroying themselves, beating themselves up.
I guess that was wrong.
The guy I'm looking at now has got several years in Alcoholics Anonymous. He has experience. He's very direct, straightforward. He knows how to say bullshit. And I need people like that in my life that know how to say bullshit. And he goes to meetings, and he's been sober about 38 years, 39 years. Now, if you really want to know how to do the steps, you need to talk to Max. Marcy, there's a little thing that's going around in this valley now, and it just recharged a lot of emotions and feelings in my program and my life, and it's called Back to the 40s. Alright? And I hope you'll get a meeting to pick it up and do it here in Visalia. But there was a process that they went through the steps in 5 hours. This takes one hour meeting for 5 weeks, and we'll get you through all 12 steps. The only thing you have to do is bring your book, your mind, and a sponsor. Alright? And it explains it all. Alright, now if you just go over to, we're on what, steps 6, 7, and 8 over there in Woodlake. In Springville, they'll start up May 1st. It's Monday night from 7 to 8 o'clock. It's a 1 hour meeting. Right. I like the idea that to doing the steps out of the big book. And 12 and 12 is too confusing. And I'll tell you why I say that. It's because I used to do H&I down in Centinella. And it was for Calipatria State Prison. And basically I was allowed to bring in big books and a 12 and 12. Well, they had a big blow up down there and they went into about a 6 month lockdown. And there was very few people from the outside going in to these meetings. I was going into a hall with 28 inmates. And we'd have these step studies. I ain't lying. And anyhow, we come off a lockdown and there's one little fellow there that, well, which book do you guys want to go? And this guy never said anything at meetings. And, he says, I would like to start back at working on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we did. Okay. I really do thank you for letting me speak.